Zimmermann speaking yesterday. I have well received the critical undertone as to the formal representation of ideas. Unfortunately, I think that this is not really quite true. I mean, if you claim that in principle you could clarify everything by narrative methods, then this is creating the illusion that this would be enough. You know, I'm afraid it's not the case. What you need is a formal mode of reflection, and this is difficult to mediate in the public, but unfortunately that is the case, as Wittgenstein would say. On the contrary, what I think is that the most important is the concept of the correct conceptualization which you are presenting to the public. And in fact, the book you mentioned as a positive example is, in my eyes, sorry to say that, not a positive example, because the terminology, as we heard in the first keynote lecture, is actually not very correct in the philosophical sense. I'm not telling about quantum information or so. Unfortunately, I was a bit late for the lecture this morning, but I've just read the book recently. The point is that I find the categories of nothingness and non-being mixed up, actually. So the consequence is that your God metaphor you presented and also your card game is actually not correct, because it's not demonstrating what you would like to demonstrate. For instance, saying that God would himself not know entails that you think of the assembly of knowledge for God or substance or whatever you would like to call it in an anthropomorphic way, which is obviously not logical at all. That is actually an idea going back to Spinoza in the 17th century. On the other hand, the card game is not actually telling anything about nothingness, because what you actually show is that if you discard a means of representation in favor of another means, for instance, by skipping the cards and doing that in an abstract way, for instance, playing blind chess, you know, you're not actually doing anything ontological. What you do is you simply switch the means of representation. So, in fact, there is not nothingness, but it's quite a lot independent of the case that nothingness itself, in philosophical terms, is not nothing. You see, that is a point. It's actually the foundation of non-being. And non-being is what is not but could be. It's a possibility. We had that already earlier in the keynote of Hofkirchner's The Field of Possibilities. And nothingness is a foundation of non-being. You see, by coincidence, on Friday afternoon, I will give a talk on nothingness at the University of London in Stuart House at 4 p.m. For making some propaganda. You see, what I mean with all of this is that obviously it's positive to present a topic from quantum information theory or quantum gravity as to that, to the general public. But the point is that if doing so, then you have, of course, to fix the correct terminology for physics on the one hand and for philosophy on the other. That is a minimum requirement, independent of the question whether you can actually fulfill your task in narrative terms instead of writing, unfortunately, one or the other formula down, you see. So, coming to a conclusion, sorry for talking so long, but unfortunately it's not easier to say. So what I think is that interdisciplinary work is fine, provided that the work itself is disciplinary, you see. I mean, you cannot actually infer that knowledge in one field is entailing knowledge in many other fields by strict forward generalization, yeah. So like Lorenz, for instance, would generalize from geese to human beings. That is unfortunately not proper, and this was my point.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to come back on that?
I don't exactly know how to reply, but guilty as charged. I'm not a philosopher.
I'm proud of that in some sense. But what I want to say is that philosophers frequently say that we physicists are very opportunistic, in the sense that we just stick to whatever interpretation is the easiest one to achieve whatever it is that we want to achieve. And after all, we want to make good predictions that will be confirmed or disproved by experiments. So you will hear many different opinions held by the same person, in fact. So we are certainly not philosophically consistent. You know, I could be many worlds on one day and then Copenhagen on another day, if that makes it easier for me to proceed. So that exists there within physics, the multitude of philosophies. And it's true that our terminology is really well-defined within our setting, which may well have a completely different meaning in different disciplines. So the slide, "Not in the Mind of God," really refers to a very specific view of reality, which would be called local hidden variables. So it's really well defined. You can put it mathematically very well. I communicated it in a grand way, just to give the impression how strong this statement is, that there are no hidden. You cannot really assume that reality exists independently of you performing measurements. Of course, when I wrote a popular book, I thought it would be more interesting to write it in a way that I speculate at the end of it. No one really, after all, wants to read a translation of a bunch of papers into ordinary language. I don't think that's very exciting. So I thought this medium provides me with something more. Maybe I try to say something deeper than just here is physics and here are the implications for information theory. So that's why I thought, I did say that it was highly speculative switching the thing around and saying, can we go beyond the laws of physics? So if you talk to me as a professional physicist, I will tell you, here is the laws of quantum physics and that's the way it is. So if you ask me, why do I have non-locality, entanglement, superpositions, then it's all encoded in the rules of quantum mechanics. And if you understand them and if you speak that language, we have nothing else to discuss, because this is the most accurate description of nature we have. But this would be a super boring statement, and it wouldn't convey why we are so excited about the whole thing and where is the mystery and so on. And I think that's my only excuse for doing that in the last part of the book. But I fully agree with the criticism. It stands. I think those who are professional will understand exactly where I'm coming from, where I cut corners and so on. So it would be difficult to write a 200-page long book and cover all the aspects pedantically. I think that wouldn't make it a good read, actually.
Thanks.
It still isn't a good read, incidentally, but it would be even worse, I think, if I...
Other comments or questions, either to individuals or to the panel as a whole? Yeah?
One of the problems about this kind of interdisciplinary discussion is that we're all dealing and concentrating on different realities. So the reality you're concerned with is very different to the reality I'm concerned with, which is, for example, what is the information content of an advertisement, which is a totally different kind of story. So we have to, if we're going to reconcile our interest in information, we've got to somehow first of all understand which kind of realities we're grounded in.
I think it's true, you know, just a quick comment. I face this already when I speak with a chemist or a biologist. So we physicists, believe that we are closer to God than anyone else, in the sense that everything else follows from fundamental laws of physics. So we can, quantum physics basically underpins chemistry, chemistry underpins biology and so on, right? But of course this is already very challenged when you enter biology, and there will be many people who say this kind of simple reductionism won't work, and in fact you won't be able to reduce our concepts necessarily all the way down to your concepts. I think most physicists would probably oppose that idea. I think we'd like to think that we can describe everything in, with the laws of physics, but we don't know, of course. And it's a big gap. I agree.
Can you explain in the advertisement and its information content through physics?
Indeed. Yeah, who knows? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it might in theory be possible to reduce everything to physics, but why would you want to if you were not a physicist? I mean, it would just be an extremely long way around of describing, for example, the properties of water, which, as I understand it, can't be described in terms of quantum physics. But a chemist would be able to describe it very, very well. You know, it's an ionic fluid, dissolves a lot of stuff. You know, that's actually very useful information. If you presented me with, you know, a tome that explained the same things in terms of quantum physics, I'm not sure you'd add anything to the, you know. So, yeah.
I mean, we saw it, incidentally, we saw it yesterday in terms of electrical circuits. You can, in principle, understand that with Maxwell's equations of electrodynamics, but no one does that. No engineer in their right mind would ever describe it like that, because a higher level description is more efficient. But it doesn't mean that it's not connected to the... Well, so at least it's pleasing to me to know that there is a connection. Yes. That's what I would say. And I never use it practically, but I know that there is a consistency between two levels.
So. Of course, it even happens within physics, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because Newtonian physics is actually quite useful, if you like, as a shortcut.
Indeed.
So,
So I believe this is the classical discussion about reductionism and projectivism. But I think one of the points that wanted to be solved or wanted to be shown as a path for reconciling this position was given by Wolfgang Hofkirchner yesterday, and also that was one of the points of our argument in the emergency of significance of meaning, because. What we have, different disciplines that are trying to understand different parts of reality. But we have we really need so a good complementarity between all of these points of view. So we need some kind of perspectivism that has to be good grounded. So for example, from one domain to another domain. You can see that there are some kind of new kind of regularities, new kind of classicity, so to say, that is like the groundings of new significance. And then you can see from the physics to the chemistry, you can get a non-deterministic path to get another domain in which you can have some kind of new significance, but it's not reductionist. And it's neither also so projectivist, because it's not going in the other direction. So it just provides a good path between both in order to get a whole consistency, but it gives also so a way in which the perspectivism could work. So I think that was the idea also of Reinhard Zimmermann, that in each discipline we have to be disciplinated in order to provide good models and to provide good paths between the different models, between the different disciplines, in order to get a real interdisciplinarity. But also in order to do that, we need some kind of whole picture of the whole reality. So how can this work? So how is it possible going from one domain to the other domain? And I think that the question about the models, I think it's also so relevant. So how do you get so new ways to understand in different domains? So it is reduced to a very practical case. So we have some problems concerning the understanding of reality. We have some other problems concerning the consistency of the models, and we have some problems concerning the practical questions. So there are different I think perspectives. So to illustrate this, in I don't know if it's so common, we use a yoke in Spain, and probably it's generalized, I don't know, but it's the problem about measuring the volume of a car. So a mathematician, a physician, and an engineer
meet together in order to solve the problem of measuring the volume of the core. And then the mathematicians say, okay, it's easy, so we just get the equation of the surface and make a surface integral, and then we get so the volume. So the physician, that's very, very difficult, no? It's much easier just putting the core into a swimming pool and then seeing how the water rises up. And then the engineer say, okay, let's suppose just a core of 1 meter, a spherical core of 1 meter radius. So I think each of these positions move in a different domain. So the mathematician move in the consistency of the epistemological model. So the physician move in the space or in the domain of ontological, so to understanding and to know so the causality of the world, and the engineer moves in a very practical situation. He wants to get something. He needs a fast solution, and I think these three are needed, and we need this also to put it together in order to get a real interdisciplinarity. So we need interdisciplinarity between different domains within science, but we need also interdisciplinarity within these different aspects of making models.
Thank you. I think there was a question or comment from the floor.
Yeah. As a comment, a little praise of interdisciplinary research, because any truth, if we can get any, is ex definition is interdisciplinary. Because if you are in your own domain, you see just really a little part of the world. And the optimal thing would be to know everything about everything. And of course, knowing everything that is known about everything, it would only give an illusion that we know everything because we cannot know what we don't know. But anyway, it may be, you know, the barrier may be the capacity of mind, because you cannot go in depth in all disciplines. But I think this is really something that is fascinating. And again, for example, in physics, if you have bad, if you want to hit the moon with your rocket, if you have bad physics, you have a very simple test. Either you hit or you don't. In philosophy, and I love philosophy, it's a bit different. Some philosophers, for example, take a word and they quote, you know, 20 definitions of the word, and they give the 21st. And sometimes, you know, I think that physics and natural sciences are a bit more realistic. And anyway, going outside of own domain is always connected with the risk, because always it can be commented by somebody that you don't know this, you haven't read that, and so on. So it is normal, but this going out of own domain is necessary to know something that really makes sense.
Hi, thank you. It's Roger Pitfield from Open University. Yes, I think that's great. I mean, I make a connection between the A, knowing A knows everything, or you know everything about A, and B, you know everything about B, but you have to put A and B together, and there's stuff that you don't know, and that's what the process we're going through today, and hopefully at other events we're experiencing. I'm also interested, because we're titled about information, and we talk about ICT, yet when we talk about advertising, that moves into the realm of communication and away from information. For me, that's my perspective. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. There are a couple of comments to chip in and see if that provokes any further discussion. Thank you.
Frank Land again. The common thing we have is that we each perceive the reality through information. What then differs amongst all individuals is that we all filter that information. We don't see that information in the same way. We see the same signal, but it means different things to us. So one of the things we have a duality between on the one hand there's the information, on the other hand there's the way we perceive that information. and they're not the same. We've got to understand that these differences exist. And we won't begin to understand each other until we begin to see what these differences are. Each individual perceives things in a very different way.
Sorry, I'm having to my two bend. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And someone said, of course, if you tell someone something that they already know, in a sense, there isn't any information in that. And you could make the argument about an advert for a product of which I have no interest. That conveys no interest to me, but information to me. But, of course, someone who was interested in that product, he could have an awful lot of information. So it's a very tricky question. It seems to me that, as it is so often the case, it all depends on the context. I talked a little bit yesterday about models, and somebody talked about information being a slippery concept. I think a model is a very slippery concept as well, because, of course, you can never have the model of anything. You can have a variety of models given particular purposes, and it seems to me that perhaps information is rather like that.
So relying again on interdisciplinarity, I see that one of the problems, it concerns of our culture. I think when was talked about the how was citizen science and the qualification of the good observations, I think one underlying assumption is that the scientific work is somehow well organized, but there's some kind of assumption also in the classical organization of the academic work that comes back to the positivism, and it supposes or it assumes a complete or almost complete analyticity of reality, and I think we are still on the trend of our universities are so specialized. Our way of looking, so not only in the universities but also in normal life, it tends to be always more individualized, but that's not the case of reality. So, for example, that's one of the things that pointed out Heisenberg from the quantum physics, is that in order to be correct, we would just need one wave equation for the whole universe. Huh? But then he answered immediately that we wouldn't have any physics, we wouldn't have any possible prediction in our world and so on. So the reality works not analytically, so we cannot divide it. So as we suppose in our normal division of labor in the academic work or also in normal life. And I think it's a question of culture. So in order to get this correct interdisciplinarity, to get another culture, in order to get to a more complete and more general points of view, also relying on the necessity of having so particular models in order to be disciplinated in each area, we need in any case some kind of common understanding of what's going on that has to be consistent. But that, I think, so the education, the whole division of scientific work and so on should be in this trend. I think we need a big change in order to be correct interdisciplinary, so correctly. That's what I think.
The discussion, as was the case yesterday, is sort of very abstract. This is also an opportunity for people to ask for further information about any of the specific projects that were talked about this morning. So we don't have to restrict ourselves to the highly philosophical.
Peter Jones, healthcare. Sorry, is it Jerry?
Yeah.
Jeff. Sorry, Jeff. You made mention of an instance-based data model. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, the idea is, so are you familiar with relational databases?
Yeah, and yeah. I've come across previously the associative approach, and I just wondered if that was something that you were heading towards or...
Well, a traditional way to build a database to store information about some domain is to construct a conceptual model that essentially says, what are the categories of phenomena about which we want to store data? So in a biological domain, it might be what are the species of interest. In a business domain, it might be, you know, what is a customer and what is a product and those sorts of things. And then you build a database that way. The instance-based approach is based on an ontological foundation that says, you know, the world consists of these things that have properties. And what we want to store is, at a more basic level, is to store information about the individual phenomena and the attributes they possess. We can then later impose categories on it by saying that the categories, I'm interested in attributes A, B, C, and D, and you can go into the database, and it's essentially a query to pull out all of the individuals that satisfy that condition, those characteristics. So the idea is to separate the categories or classes of interest from the underlying data. And that's typically that's not done in databases technology. So, and the idea is that you get much more flexibility. You're not constrained to a particular view of the world. It's easier to integrate information. One of the things that I didn't talk about, but if you're building a database for a project and you're interested in, you know, what's the biodiversity, what's the distribution of species in a particular domain, That's you sort of have a set of questions in mind when you build it, and you build it with those questions in mind, which might make it difficult to answer a different set of questions. So, for example, if I'm an environmental regulation and I'm interested in some biological information, I might be interested in the fact that certain organisms, I don't care what species they are, were observed on a beach covered in oil. The fact that they're a particular species of bird or a seal or whatever is irrelevant. It's a different attribute that I'm interested in. Traditional approaches to information don't allow you to easily integrate these different sources of data that are constructed to answer specific questions, but we think the instance-based approach gives you much more flexibility to allow you to integrate information more usefully.
Okay. Are you doing that from the bottom up?
From the bottom up, yes.
Right, okay. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yes, you can consider it that, yeah, I think.
I see that, considering Kuhn's perspective of evolution of science, so that would work in a part in which we have so normal science. But what would it happen, so if we need so some breakthrough, so we cannot cope with some kind of reality, with a reality, and we need another theory. So it reminds me, so to the history of the classification of species in the 17th and the 18th century, there was so many different traits of classification along the 18th century that one of the problems was that they couldn't cope with all the variety of species that was determined. Because I think the what you mentioned now is just an Aristotelic point of view in which you can find so the attributes of the reality that is there, and then you can classify this reality. But actually, the problem in the 18th century with concerning the classification of species was that. So every 10 years there was a different tree, a different relation between them, and they needed to get a global picture of the whole thing. So that is how at the beginning of the 19th century, but it was already shown at the end of the 18th century that we need a new idea, and so is how the idea of evolution came from. So until Darwin times, but it was a relatively long, for the creation of this idea of evolution, but it was needed so the collapse of this normal science. So I see that this concerning also on the what's the name, citizen science. It's more in this normal science. So I don't know what do you think. So what would we need for a revolutionary change, so we need global pictures, so that's the idea.
I don't think I have an answer to that last question, but I guess, I mean, I'm very much a pragmatist and interested in solving problems, but I would say is that how we choose to organize information constrains, it does put us into this normal science box. It constrains how we view the world, how we deal with the world, how we communicate, and so on. And that's very much the case in information technology in terms of especially how data are organized. If you want to create the opportunity to allow greater flexibility, different perspectives and different ways looking on it. This is what I was trying to talk about. There's just one way of taking things down to a lower level so that the constructs that you're working with are more basic constructs that you can then assemble in different ways and maybe get different perspectives. I don't really think that answers your question, but I think that's all I can say about it.
Christian speaking. I like the idea of the database because it shows how sometimes we choose an instrument fairly early on in the process of the research, and then it determines the way we can approach the problem. And sometimes we take it as a given that the relational database might be the right thing to have, and then not. But I was just wondering, does it go into the direction of teching as well? Like you could have very simple approaches to a similar approach, and if that's the case, then do we need the associative database? I mean, what would be then the benefit of having that sort of solution rather than something which is already established in the social media domain and where people are already comfortable with it or so on? But I suppose there is a difference between the two approaches?
Well, they're definitely related. Tagging is a useful a phenomenon in social media, but the problem, the issue is that tagging is very, very messy. It can be very messy, and there are ways of imposing some structure on tags, which becomes similar to the notion of attributes. And you can start to view tags as attributes if you want to. But there are other issues as well, in that tagging is kind of a flat structure, whereas we may conceive of attributes as having some kind of hierarchical or lattice-like arrangement that allows you to make inferences about some attributes based on others. This is a bit maybe technical for the general audience.
Probably, but we could bring it back to the level of information because essentially what we then are asking for are shared ontologies, and this is non-technical. So, and I guess then we get into murky waters because there are so many ways to tag and label, and no matter what technology we would use, we still have the problem of shared ontologies, which is a very old problem, and I'm not sure whether we ever get to it.
Yeah.
Thinking about the kind of
work we do here on semantic web, if I take what you were just saying and think about the kind of transgressions that we are making when we cross disciplines, and in terms of speech acts, for instance, if we're going kind of performative direction, we have people who are outside their comfort zone, and that they're not obeying the kind of conditions for the felicitous speech acts. That they may try to, but if I'm in my comfort zone, I know what kinds of utterances are legitimate within that and can be classified in terms of warnings or whatever else. But if I'm a non-specialist or operating in a different area, what am I doing? I may well be in a strange land, not obeying the rules. And that matters when you're thinking about how we make advances here. In physics, there is this notion of not even wrong, of having a kind of an idea that is just inadequate on so many levels, it's not even worth discussing. You know, the Pauling kind of comments. If you think about how you take that forward for the ontologies in different areas, how do we recognize the difference between, let's take a case of putting two words together, chemical physics and physical chemistry. That they are completely different things. I've published in both. But when I think, how do you get people beginning to talk to each other in a way that's felicitous? How do you analyze it? How would you characterize the kind of conversations we're having here if you wanted subsequently to be able to find your way to a particular notion, a particular approach? It's pretty difficult. You're going to have multiple descriptions, multiple semantics here.
David Chapman. A couple of thoughts. One thing is that the phrase, the map is not the territory, has been sort of buzzing through my head through a lot of this conversation, which those of us who were at the film last night, it was a sort of a theme of Gregory Bateson's. And it seems to me that we've actually, when you're looking at interdisciplinary work, you've got lots of different maps, and none of them are the territory. But the other thought, I don't know whether any thoughts come together, but another thought is the, what does it mean to understand anything? And it seems to me that understanding something is all about analogies. And to me, one of the reasons why it's important to discuss information at the moment is that analogies, historically, analogies of the world have often been based on technology. So that, for example, in the great age of mechanical technology, then you saw the world as, in terms of clockwork and the brain as a sort of mechanical device. And now, in the age of information, we're seeing analogies in terms of information. And so I see that in the conversation we're having now about the databases, for example. We're talking about the natural world in terms of databases. Again, with this sort of the idea of understanding through analogy, that one of the advantages of interdisciplinary work is you get sort of new analogies that you could help understanding your own discipline through an analogy that somebody else is using in a different discipline.
I would like to point concerning so the analogy. I think that for the interdisciplinarity, more than the analogies, and also for a whole picture of how our scientific understanding is, I think it's better the idea of metaphors. So we need good metaphors so for getting a good understanding. And so, for example, I think it's possible to reconstruct the whole history of science like an evolution of good metaphors, or even better metaphors. And I think that's some crucial point in order to articulate a good interdisciplinarity. So I agree in the analogy, but I think so metaphor, it's a broader idea concept.
Just picking up on that last point, if it's a case that we have successive metaphors and we could possibly project back even earlier than a kind of mechanical metaphor, what possible implications does that have for the finality or any proposal for finality for any hierarchical pictures of the universe of the type presented, for example, in the Unified Theory of Information, Florides' picture, and other emergentist models? I mean, if they're just fundamentally grounded in metaphors and the metaphors change, who's to say that these models won't be completely discarded, these frameworks won't be completely discarded at some point?
Okay. I think that's interesting, and I would rely again in some of the ideas given by Wolfgang Hofkirchner, and it's concerning to the space of possibilities and the non-deterministic way of the evolution of reality. There are always a broad tree of possibilities concerning so our next world, our future world, and I believe it depends also on these metaphors. So how is going to be so the future? So we also interact with the world. So it's not just that we are so neutral observers, but we have some kind of teleology and we need to solve some contradictions also which are real. They are real, so the contradictions. But there is not a unique path for getting that. So if we are living in an evolving universe, we need to find so good paths also to solve these different oppositions and contradictions. And I think one of the points that is lost by this analyticity of the academic work is just to get this global picture driving by good metaphors that allows us to know the reality, So in order, which are the real possibilities of this world? So that concerns so how the world it works, but it also concerns so what kind of the possibilities of the world in the future is preferred, and it has an important pragmatical so dimension. So is our future so desirable that's in the ideas of the German philosopher Ernst Bloch. So we need some kind of good utopies, and this good utopia or these utopies are also rely also on the models of our world.
We're coming, John Monk. Last two questions, John. Do you want to say? Okay, then. We might as well take the two points together, and then we'll finish off.
Okay, it's Ambjörn Neve from Stockholm. I want to come back to this relationship ideas and explanations that you were talking about, David, and others also. There's a quote, a famous quote from Henri Poincaré. The aim of science is not things themselves, as the dogmatists in their simplicity imagine, but the relations between things. Outside those relations, there's no reality knowable. Those are the words of Poincaré from 1905 or something. And basically in mathematics, you know, when we want to find out something about a space, what we very often do is we map this space into a known space. For instance, we map a space of functions into the real numbers and we create a dual space. And then we lift the properties back from the known space into the unknown space. That has a fantastic property of conserving disjointness. So if something is disjoint in the known space, it becomes disjoint when we lift it back. It's called the inverse functor in category theory. And that's how we very often construct concepts in an unknown space, by lifting back known concepts. This is the essence of metaphor or analogy, because to me, an explanation is just a mapping between two ontologies. And those ontologies can be described in category theories, diagrams, and the explanation then becomes a functor, which conserves, basically the metaphor is taking a path in the one side, lifting it over to the other, and you get a path in the other. And the more paths that you can lift over, the stronger the metaphor becomes. And this is a level I think that this is going to take. In 100 years, we're going to describe this in terms of abstract category theory. It's not very much known outside abstract mathematics now, but it's happening, and it's extremely exciting.
John, you look as though you want to say something. Would you like to have the final word this morning?
Oh, dear. well, it's about metaphor, and I'm slightly worried about the last comment, because it kind of makes metaphor a kind of mechanical business, and for me, metaphor is not a mechanical business. It's that you use a word in a new context because it has certain kind of feelings and affordances associated with it. And I feel that's what when we're talking about information here, perhaps everybody thinks their discipline knows what information is. And in their discipline, they use that word in particular ways. They attribute certain kinds of properties, they attribute certain kinds of affordances, and they develop a way of talking about information. Every discipline does that, but every discipline uses that same word, information, because they also find hints about the ways in which they can develop their notion of information in the way it is used in other places. So metaphor for me is the use of a word in a new context, but perhaps because we're all using the word information, it's not so much that we have transported the word, we're already using it. It's what we do is we borrow some of the affordances. They give us insights into things within our discipline because what has been stated and discovered in other disciplines. And that to me is not a mechanical process. But it's a creative process.
Okay, so I think that's a very good point on which to end and possibly to spark off further discussion over lunch.
It was a mechanical process. But basically, think of your own brain patterns as these ontologies. They happen all the time, and you create them, and you map one brain pattern to another. And this is a biological, very creative, very effective, emotional process. And that's part of the problem, because we do this in a tacit way, in an implicit way. We are not aware of us doing it either.
Thank you. Can we thank all the presenters this morning for what I think has been an extremely interesting session?